Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
This is PRN.FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how chili and ginger can help battle cancer in the body from the American Chemical Society. Too much television time, bad for kids' blood pressure. NutraSweet, according to this new study, is linked to leukemia and lymphomas, and that's in an awful lot of products, hundreds if not thousands of products. And also today we'll be looking at the environment. We're going to examine how pesticide companies, their own secret tests showed their products harm bees. We'll give you the latest on that. And the new climate math. Now this is from mainstream climate research. We have 17 years to get off fossil fuel or else. So that timeline is rapidly getting at us, but it's probably in the next 5 years we'll start to see some cataclysmic events occurring, including regular Category 5 hurricanes, possibly Category 6, and a lot more. My guest in the second part of our program to talk about the wisdom of frugality. A time for us to reconsider the benefits of living a more simple life. Professor Imrys Westacott, professor of philosophy at Alfred University, and where he focuses on the ethics of living, history of philosophy. So that'll be a very interesting discussion. And time permitting, we're going to take you to a congressional hearing where there's a very short clip, an audio clip, of why we can import vegetables and fish from anywhere in the world without a problem, but we cannot import medication from Canada made from the same identical corporation that makes it in the United States and save a huge amount of money. Also, lying politicians cannot explain the $9 trillion missing from the Federal Reserve. And also, there's a pipeline running from Houston, Texas, to New York, and it ruptured. You wouldn't know it from the media. So it ruptured right in central Alabama. And 250,000 gallons of gasoline spilled. We'll deal with that. And we have some other issues, if time permits. Let's begin. We know that children are watching too much television. In fact, more than 1 hour a day is too much. This is the latest from Reuters. Quote, you knew that too much could be bad for kids in general. Now, hence a study released Monday, that too much time in front of the television, even playing video games, may increase a child's risk of developing high blood pressure. The findings held regardless of whether the children were overweight or thin. Quote, we've known from previous studies that sedentary behaviors are linked to obesity, and that obesity is linked to high blood pressure. But this is the first time that we've linked those behaviors directly to elevated blood pressure. And that's according to Dr. Joey Einsman of Michigan State University. So, let's find ways that we can engage children, let them engage the world outside, let them have more green time, let them spend time just being kids, and that'll help their blood pressure, and it'll help their brain. NutraSweet. I remember when I debated the owner of the NutraSweet company in Washington, D.C. We had evidence at that time of its dangers. But because of the politics of Washington, it was not to be that it would be banned. Now a new study, and by the way, there are over 900 studies have been published on aspartame, including one in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. But the new research has shown a connection between lymphoma, leukemia, and the artificial sweetener aspartame. As far back as 2005, the FDA approved this synthetic sweetener for use in 1981, and currently it's used in over 6,000 products. It can be sold under NutraSweet Equal Measure Spoonful. It can be found in sodas, desserts, yogurt, even chewable vitamins. So if you're concerned about NutraSweet and its health implications, then think about also something we're not paying attention to and we should is high fructose corn syrup. Now, it's been a staple in the American diet for a long time, and the U.S. food manufacturing industry has found high fructose corn syrup to be one of the cheapest sweeteners available. And because of this, it's found in a vast array of foods, including not only soda, but candy bars, baby food, breakfast cereals, yogurt, salad dressings, baked goods. And we consume about 27 pounds of high fructose corn syrup a year per person. And now that is not the same as the fructose you find naturally in fruit. Remember, in fruit you also have fiber, you have all the antioxidants, you have nutrients, you have polyphenols, and that slows the body's absorption of the natural fructose. Also, you have the omega-3 fatty acids, and now we're finding that the omega-3 fatty acids can help reverse some of the harmful effects of fructose. And what they found in this study was to reverse any damage done by fructose, be sure to incorporate the omega-3 fatty acid, DHA, into your diet. The body cannot produce DHA, by the way. You have to supplement it to get it in. And it's found in, of course, salmon and other fish, like mackerel and trout and sardines. Those are some of the richest sources, but you can also find it in nuts and seeds, like walnuts, whole grains, dark leafy vegetables. So vegans can get it also. But the best thing is don't use the high fructose corn syrup to begin with. From the American Chemical Society, consuming gingerol, that is not ginger ale, it's gingerol, and capsaicin together, that would be your hot pepper, your chili pepper, and ginger, could combat cancer. And in fact, it's strongly so. That's according to the new research that's out. So I would suggest having, and this was published in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry, I would suggest having some ginger every day. You can stir fry it, or you can juice it. If you juice a piece about 1 inch in length, you're going to get the most benefit. Why? Because there's a particular chemical in gingerol. It's called 6-gingerol, and it's what gives ginger that kind of pungent quality, but it's very powerful regarding cancer prevention. So ginger and hot pepper for cancer prevention. Also, according to Georgia State University, incorporating laughter into a physical activity program that is focused on strength, balance, and flexibility could improve older adults' mental health. In the study, older adults residing in 4 assisted living facilities participated in a moderate intensity group exercise program called Laugh Active, and that incorporates playful, simulated laughter into a strength and balance and flexible workout. And they found it made a huge difference. Made a difference in them being able to benefit more from their exercise. They did this for six weeks. So that makes a big difference to laugh. And one of the things that happens when we laugh is that we're secreting a lot of good hormones, the endorphins, the natural opiates. So laughter helps reduce pain in the body. Laughter also helps us create a good mood for about 6 hours. So good laughter, good belly laugh, each day, it's like eating an apple, keeps the doctor away. And what I'm hopeful to do in the next 12 months, now that I'm getting almost caught up with all my projects, I have just a couple more months of working on a documentary and a couple more weeks on another documentary, and I'll be caught up. Then I'm going to look at Singh can open up a one demonstrated example for people, a holistic assisted living center. So right now, let's say you go to an assisted living center and you go in and you watch television all day. You have your own room and you can go downstairs and eat with everyone else, and there's a nurse on premises. It's not very exciting. It's rather boring. But that's when people no longer want to maintain a home. Maybe they have had a spouse die. Maybe they're alone. And so it does give them a chance to socialize. But imagine this. Imagine if you gave them all healthy meals, the same kind of meals you get at a health retreat, and you had nutritionists on staff that could help give them specific functional foods and functional nutrients, herbs, botanicals, homeopathy. Imagine if they could have yoga, meditation, and challenging games, not passive. Imagine also if they could get hyperbaric intravenous nutrients. Then you could biologically reverse that person's aging and get them to where they're so healthy and so aware and so filled with cognition they could go back out into their life. In effect, turn that hourglass upside down so the sand's starting to go in the other direction. That's possible. But we only know that it works if we do it. So I'm going to be making that a project for the next 12 months. And from Southern Medical University, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine, folic acid supplementation is associated with declining in kidney disease progression. Now, we have a lot of people who have kidney disease, and in this study, there were 15,000 participants, and they were given 800 micrograms of folic acid each day. Quote, our study is the first to show significant renal, that's your kidneys, protection from folic acid therapy in a population without folic acid fortification. Given the magnitude of renal protection suggested by this study, as well as the safety and low cost, the potential role of folic acid therapy in the clinical management of patients with chronic kidney disease in regions without folic acid fortification should be vigorously examined. That's a very positive recommendation for folic acid for people with kidney disease. I wouldn't suggest 800 micrograms. I would suggest 1,000 micrograms or 1 milligram, and it's important to get them methylated. And also, from the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition, choline, that's C-H-O-L-I-N-E, and betaine, B-E-T-A-I-N-E, these are nutrients. They can help counter insulin resistance. That's a big deal when you consider that we have about 100 million pre-diabetics and diabetics, and a lot of them have insulin resistance. So something that simple, choline and betaine, could make a huge difference, and also for diabetics as well. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world and all the programs that are taking this in different cities. Thank you. Pesticide companies have been hiding some really bad news. According to Common Dreams, quote, agrochemical giants Syngenta and Bayer discovered in their own tests that pesticides cause severe harm to bees. That's according to unpublished documents obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request by the environmental group Greenpeace. And the companies conducted the trials on products that use the controversial pesticide known as neonicotinoids, or neonics, which have long been linked to rapid bee decline. And these neonicotinoids are also the world's most commonly used pesticide. according to their own studies, Syngenta and Bayer's neonicotinoids were found to cause severe harm at high levels of use. So, for those of us who want to see the bee populations come back, because we've had up to 50% destruction of all the bees in the United States, but if you've noticed in organic beekeepers, we don't have that. Now, I'm a beekeeper. I've had bees since my first farm, the Fertiller Farm, upstate New York, and where I used to teach people about why it was important to not take the honey of the bees, let them eat that honey each day in the winter when they don't have anything to forage, and also how to protect the bee colonies from excessive cold and wind, and so that they survive, and not to transport them around, all of which is what's done now. They fill them, they feed the bees corn syrup. Well, that's devastating to their immune systems. Then they're spraying all these crops, like the almond trees and everything else, the apple orchards, and then wonder why these bees are dying. Well, it's the pesticides. It's that simple. Weakens their immune system. So we don't have colony collapse. They do. Bees are responsible for pollinating 1/3 of all of our food that we eat. If we didn't have bees, we wouldn't have that food. So it's a big issue. Also, from our environment, there is a new study, and here's what it says. Quote, though it may not have seemed possible, climate catastrophe is even closer than previously thought, with new figures released yesterday when the wells already drilled, pits dug, and they're referring to oil wells and gas hydro pits here, and pipelines built, are under consideration. We are well on our way to going beyond 2 Celsius of warming. If you're in a hole, stop digging, begins the study put forth by the fossil fuel watchdog Oil Change International in partnership with 14 other environmental organizations. And it talks about how we, at the most optimistic, we have about 17 years before we start finding major species extinction. They're becoming extinct every day, but until we virtually have wiped out most of the species on the planet, and where it would be very difficult for the vast majority of people on the earth to survive. So that's how close we are. Now, if they're saying 17 years, you have to consider this. Just this morning, it was determined that they had mismeasured Iceland's melt. And that's because the proximity of Greenland's melt, because of its proximity to Iceland. Iceland has all these volcanoes, and the volcanoes were giving a false reading because of the heat that they create. As a result, they say that they've lost a lot more water from Greenland. So remember I said about 8 years ago, almost 9 years ago now, that you cannot accurately predict when disasters are going to happen because we're in chaos theory. That means for those people who don't want to take any responsibility and say, oh, it's sometime in the future, we'll all be dead by then. No, we won't. And if you want to know how soon it is, why don't you ask the people in Louisiana who didn't have flood insurance, because most of their areas where they live in those parishes didn't have flooding until the entire state was flooded. Hundreds of thousands of people, if not a couple million people, their homes destroyed and no insurance. Or take the different areas where the water is encroaching and people continue to build. Now, that's just foolish, but that's what's happening. So we're in climate catastrophe now, but it's going to get real bad, real fast, within the next 5 years. Bernie Sanders kept asking this man, who's the FDA commissioner, and who is absolutely probably the worst FDA commissioner you could imagine. He's 100% pro-Big Pharma. If you can have fish from anywhere in the world, China, Thailand, and chickens come into the United States to be sold without a problem, and vegetables, why do you have such a big problem having something come in from Canada where it's the same identical manufacturer, but they're making a generic, inexpensive product in Canada they could save billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars a year. And the man couldn't give an answer, just could not give an answer. It was, you know, and that's unfortunate because nothing will happen because of this. These hearings, where some legislators rightly become offended, nothing happens from them. We're going to take a brief break and come back with my guest. Please stay with us.
Sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before, no, no. Yeah. I just want to tell you right now that ooh, I believe, I really do believe that. Something's got a hold on me here.
Oh, I must be the...
Oh, something's got a hold on me right now, child.
Oh, I must be the...
Let me tell you now, I've got a feeling, I feel so strange. Everything about me seems to have changed. Step by step, I got a brand new walk. I even sound sweeter when I talk. I said, oh,
oh.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to go to our guests in a moment, but I want to play you this under 2-minute clip that we have working now with Bernie Sanders challenging the head of the FDA.
We can import lettuce and tomato vegetables from farms all over the world, but somehow we cannot re-import from Canada brand name prescription drugs manufactured by the largest drug companies of the world. Can you explain to me, and do you support the reimportation of brand name prescription drugs from major companies from Canada and from other major industrialized countries? Yes, no?
Senator, as you're aware from our previous discussion, we have major concerns about reimportation, the system it would take to make sure that the drugs are adequate.
In other words, do you think we can bring in fish products and vegetables from farms all over the world, but we cannot bring from across the Canadian border brand name drugs? You don't think we have the capability of doing that?
We have the capability. It would add additional cost, and systems would have to be put into place.
Well, this is why precisely the American people are paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. It is beyond my comprehension that you're sitting here saying we can bring in vegetables and fish from all over the world, but we cannot bring in brand name drugs manufactured by the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world from a country like Canada. I just do not...
And that's Bernie Sanders. And that's one of the reasons why, when it comes to the amount you pay for a prescription drug, you are not given the advantage through Medicare or Medicaid or the VA of getting the same identical drug. Now, this is not even arguing whether or not the drug is safe or effective. This is just arguing your physician and you take getting that drug for you. And think if you could pay $20 for a drug through getting it directly as a generic drug or getting the high-end brand name, same identical drug, made from the same company, but for $1,000 for a month's supply. And that's why so many people have gone broke. So Sanders on that one was asking the right questions. Unfortunately, nothing will come from it. Too much money has been spent to... in effect, align the legislators with the pharmaceuticals' interest. My guest from Alfred, New York, I mentioned him a little earlier at the beginning of the program, is Professor Emrys Westacott, Professor of Philosophy at Alfred University, where he has focused on issues related to ethics, the history of philosophy, and how the discipline of philosophy can be practically engaged in a way of reflecting the modern lifestyle. Originally from the United Kingdom, he studied and received his degrees from the University of Sheffield, United Kingdom, McGill University of Montreal, and University of Texas. And he has written a lot for different publications on his positions, and he has written 3 books, and his most recent from Princeton University Press is called Wisdom of Frugality, Why Less is More, More is Less. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
There is a story that I was reading this morning. I just want to quote a few sentences of it. This is from Michael Snyder. It's called Living in a Van Down by the River, Time to Face the True State of the Middle Class in America. Quote, do you remember the old Saturday Night Live sketches in which comedian Chris Farley portrayed a motivational speaker that lived in a van by the river? Unfortunately, this is becoming a reality for way too many Americans. As the middle class has shrunk and the cost of living has increased, a lot of people have decided to quite literally live on the road. Whether it's a car, a truck, a van, or a bus or an RV, an increasing number of Americans are using their vehicles as their homes. Just recently, someone that I know took a trip down the west coast of the United States and stayed at a number of campgrounds along the way. What she discovered was that a lot of people were actually living at these campgrounds. Of course, there are some that actually prefer that lifestyle, but many others are doing it out of necessity. Earlier this week, Circa.com posted a story about the van life, and then it goes on to talk about how common it is for people who simply do not make enough money to be able to afford monthly rents that are astronomical in many places, or to purchase a home, so they have no other option at this moment. So I wanted to just let the audience know that in all of the hoopla of saying how great everyone's doing, there are a lot of people who are not. So I've been a strong advocate for observing beauty and a sense of freedom in living simply. Yet it seems that there have always been two options related to why a person lives simply. One is out of a personal choice, and what we might call this wise decision. And the other is out of necessity because the financial situation in that group is simply beyond their capacity to do anything else except to live frugally. So go to any Walmart on Black Friday and you can see the dark side behind this. And now we're in an economic moment in the history of Western civilization, and especially in the United States and other developed countries, when it is impossible for everyone to enter the secure middle class or even higher. And more people are falling into poverty and being forced to live simply, frugal lives, beyond their freedom to choose. And an article this week highlights that, and I just mentioned some of it. So please explain to us, take your time, no rushing this, that some of the ancient sages, such as Socrates and the Stoics and the Epicureans and others, such as the Transcendentalists in the 19th century, what they had to say about the benefits and wisdom of adopting a simple lifestyle as a personal choice that a person can make. And among the philosophers of the past, which one have you found to have the greatest wisdom and on how to live simply for us today? The forum is yours.
Okay. I think let's take a couple of questions, one by one. The benefits of living simply, right? And I'm putting off the very interesting distinction you make between, an important distinction between where it's a choice and where it's forced on one. But the benefits of living simply, according to the frugal tradition, going back to Socrates and including people like the Epicurus and the Stoics and Thomas More and Rousseau and David Henry Thoreau. Basically, there are two kinds of benefits. One is moral, the other has to do with happiness. The moral benefits are various. To some extent, people think that simply living frugally and simply is itself a virtue. Others see it as more a sign of integrity. Think of how, for instance, when the present Pope was selected, there was an immediate, a lot of people immediately pointed to the fact that he favored a simple lifestyle. He eschewed living in the Vatican palaces, and that was a sign of integrity. People even point to Warren Buffett still living in his house that he bought in 1958 as, you know, a sign of his sort of wisdom and integrity, when he could obviously live much more opulently. Living simply, suppose, according to some of these thinkers, it keeps one away from temptation. It inculcates virtues like resilience, being able to cope with adversity, and this kind of thing. So that's one slew of arguments, which is that it's morally beneficial to you and indirectly to your community. The other kind of argument is that basically simple living is the surest route to happiness. And there's a whole variety of reasons why these philosophers argue that. For example, one is that it encourages it. It leads you to be content with simple pleasures, and so you're just more content with life. A related argument is that it actually encourages you or enables you to appreciate more the simple pleasures of a sunset, of a warm summer evening, of simple food, of conversation with friends, this kind of thing. Another argument would be that simple living keeps you close to nature, which is from a certain philosophical point of view, is an essential need that we have. Another argument is that it focuses you on what really matters in life as opposed to what really doesn't. I mean, what really matters in life, that is friends, relationships, love, intellectual stimulation, perhaps simple pleasures and the like. And what really doesn't matter is having another big house, another big sailboat, being able to claim that you've gone to all these exotic places and this kind of thing. So, those are the two avenues of argument they use: the moral arguments that it's good for your soul kind of thing, and the prudential arguments, which is that you'll be happier. Now, and of these philosophers, I'll say one of my heroes is Epicurus, the founder of Epicureanism, who basically says that the fundamental good in life is pleasure. But contrary to popular mythologies about Epicurus, he wasn't particularly advocating that everyone just go in for endless indulgence, sensual indulgence, and this kind of thing. There's a beautiful line from Epicurus where he says to a friend, "Send me some cheese so that I may have a feast." And it's his idea of a good time was a bowl of wine, a dish of cheese, and good conversation with beloved friends. Now, taking up that distinction you made between frugality that's forced and frugality that's chosen, I think that's a really interesting and important distinction. And it's true that on the one hand, you read Epicurus and some of the others, and you could sort of say to almost anyone, you've got all you need. If you've got a roof over your head, you've got clothes to keep you more or less warm, you've got sufficient food to keep you alive, and you've got some company, then you've got all it needs. However, most people would say that's not very realistic in our modern society. One problem that people have is they suffer significant amounts of anxiety at the prospect of, for instance, that they won't be able to get adequate health care should they fall sick, that maybe the roof over their head will be taken away because they'll be evicted because they can't pay the rent. So there's levels of anxiety there, being poor exposes you to. And the other problem is that we live in a certain kind of society, a certain kind of culture, where our relative status to our fellow citizens, it's pretty important. It's simply not easy for most people to feel good about life and good about themselves if they are constantly reminded, every day that they are at the bottom of the heap. Now, you could be very purist about this, and you could say, well, if they really, really embraced Stoicism or Epicureanism or the other wisdom of these sages, they absolutely would be indifferent to what other people think. And, someone like Socrates seems to more or less embody that kind of indifference. But he's kind of superhuman in that respect. Most people aren't like that. Most of us put an awful lot of store on, our relative status. In my view, therefore, one of the important orientations of public policy should be to make sure that everyone has a sufficient minimum so that they're less exposed to that sort of both the anxieties of not being able to get health care, not being able to have adequate, shelter or transportation or something, or education. And the other thing is to make sure that people not everyone's going to be equal in society, but that they're not degraded. They're not objects of contempt.
Good. I appreciate that overview. One of the most important motivators today that is contributing to more and more people starting to look at a simple lifestyle more realistically has been climate change and its adverse impact upon the environment and resources. The fact is, we are unable to live like the World War II generation, my parents' generation, who assumed our resources were abundant and infinite, especially food and water, and now even oil and gas due to the approaching peak levels. The fossil fuel industry watchdog Oil Change International this week reported that we have 17 years to get completely off fossil fuels, or we are facing substantial challenges, ones that would be considered catastrophic. So can you speak about the urgency today for people to learn to live frugally? And how do you see climate change and global warming completely altering our lifestyles that assume we can get anything we want?
Sure. In the book that I've just written, The Wisdom of Frugality, the first chapters talk about the frugal tradition, right, and go over some of the arguments I've just mentioned. And they also look seriously at the question whether perhaps some of these philosophers haven't underestimated the pleasure and the value of luxury and extravagance. The last two chapters tackle issues which I think that the great sages in this tradition really didn't consider. One set of problems has to do with the fact that they were writing in much, much simpler economies where it wasn't perhaps necessary for there to be the same amount of economic activity to keep everyone happy and employed. The final chapter is on the environmentalist case for simple living. You pick out global warming as crucial, and I agree with that, although in that chapter I also discuss a little bit other things like pollution of waterways, like the extinction of species and deforestation and destruction of a habitat and things like that. It seems to me that the environmentalist argument for moving in the direction of simple living is one that you couldn't expect the philosophers in the tradition to really think about, because the population was so much smaller and the Industrial Revolution hadn't really kicked in with all its consequences. But now, of course, the population is well over 6 billion of the world, and the increase in global temperatures is continues apace. So it seems to me that it's a very, very strong argument in this direction. In that chapter, what I do is I do consider possible objections to it, along the lines of, for instance, some people say that the cure for global warming isn't simple living. It's basically we want more and better technology. The cure will be technological, and the way to ensure to produce the kind of technology is basically to have more and more productive economies producing more and more wealth, which will finance more and more research into the technology we need to halt global warming and other environmental problems. To me, that's a strange kind of argument. Because it's the technology and the industry that's brought us into this mess in the first place. And, you would think the first thing to do when you've got a problem, like if you've got emphysema, the first thing is to stop smoking. If you're, seriously overweight, the first thing to do is to cut down on how much you eat and get some more exercise, rather than, get fatter and hope that will produce, more research or stimulate more research into the problem. Another argument you get against the claim that what we need is a movement towards simple living is the argument that what individuals do by themselves isn't going to make that much difference. Each individual, if I recycle, big deal. If I hang my clothes out on the line, if I try to cut down on the amount that I drive and all this kind of thing, that what one individual can do is minuscule compared to the impact that will be made by transformative government policies, by enlightened corporate activities and this kind of thing. I certainly think it's true that most of all we need enlightened government policies and a change in corporate activities, but I don't think that's a reason to belittle the efforts of individuals. And the reason is partly because every little bit helps, just that little bit, but also because I think it's very important to promote a culture a widespread culture in which people want to recycle, people want to reduce their ecological footprint. And I think actually there's been there's been some success in that direction. I think in many countries, in many of the prosperous countries that have most contributed to environmental problems and global warming, there is, a growing default mode in our mindset of trying to make our little, you know, bit count. And I think that shouldn't be underestimated.
Good. Looking back at the 1960s and 70s, when there were experiments and alternative lifestyles, and simplicity became identified with the idea of return to nature, also in the 1970s, appeared the important book by the British economist Ernest Shoemaker, Small Was Beautiful,
right.
A book heavily influenced by Christian mysticism, but argued that realistic economics must put humans and the environment front and center, not corporate interests and massive accumulation of wealth among a few. Today, with the American dream out of reach for the vast majority of citizens, with cost of living increasing as salaries either stagnate or far below a person's level of skills and education, there's again signs of a trend towards simplicity. I observe this especially among many of the younger generation who are simply forced to experiment with other modes of living different from that of their parents. There was a poll about a year ago among millennials, and the majority felt that they would never own their own home in their lifetimes. And since you're an educator at the university level and have observed generational trends among young adults over the years, what can you share about the path of simplicity among millennials? And do you observe anything different about the millennials' approach to simplicity compared to other periods in history when simplicity and frugality were regarded as virtues in a path to inner wisdom?
Right. I'd like to think that what you say there is true, that among millennials there is a growing interest in doing things on a smaller scale, on getting closer to nature, on being more self-sufficient and embracing some of these values and ideals. I have to say, I don't know whether what we're witnessing the beginning of a sea change or not. I know, you know, well, plenty of people, young people, who are inspired. I mean, not inspired by these ideals. And I don't think it's entirely just a matter of, oh, well, I can't possibly afford an apartment in Brooklyn, so I might as well go back to the land or something. I don't think it's just being pushed out of necessity in that direction. I think that there is a real interest in these values, the ones you described. And I noticed, for instance, before I came on, you played a clip from Bernie Sanders, and of course he inspired a lot of younger people with an alternative set of values. And I think that the values that we're talking about, the back to, you know, to some extent back to nature, to some extent doing things on a smaller scale, to some extent trying to find an alternative to the values of corporate capitalism, which just are so ubiquitous and which are taken for granted by the political mainstream. I think I'd like to say we're witnessing the beginning of a sea change. I'd hope we are. I have to say that I don't know if that is true. I just, because I'm always a little bit suspicious of just anecdotal evidence. The fact that I happen to know lots of people like that, well then, you know, I have those values too.
Hmm. Something we hear frequently from people who are affluent and live extravagant lives is that they are empathetic with the plight of the poor and underprivileged. We hear this from Goldman Sachs chairman Lloyd Blankfein when, in the context of the foreclosure epidemic in 2009, people falling into poverty, people being scammed with mortgages, that Wall Street and Blankfein in particular are doing what he called God's work. J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon appeared on Fox Network declaring that the banks are being turned into victims and this is a form of discrimination that must be stopped. And we hear echoes of this in Donald Trump's speeches, a multi-billionaire who consistently claims he can identify with the struggles of white workers. Since when? So we observe a self-righteousness among the corporate and banking elite when they actually believe they are the upholders of civil rights, and that it is their critics who are really the evil ones. And yet there can be no question that their lifestyles are anything but frugal or simple. People in the lower income bracket have little choice but to embrace simplicity solely to survive. So I'm curious to know, in your research into the philosophy of ethics, what you make of the argument by the global elites, such as Blankfein and Diamond, that they are capable of being empathetic, and what relationship do you see between adopting a simple lifestyle with the cultivation of an authentic empathy towards others that can enhance relationships with others and community building and cooperation between people?
Okay. Well, I'm going to be blunt here. I just think they're full of it. I don't really take seriously those claims to empathy. These very rich people, these are, you know, the richest of the rich. This is the ruling class we're talking about. They put huge amounts of money into making sure that the government pursues policies that benefit corporations and very rich people at the expense of the majority. To be specific, for instance, one of the things I argue in the book towards the end is that one important way in which we could move towards a simpler lifestyle, everyone living a slightly better lifestyle, would be for people to work less. That is, let's say, work 30 hours a week instead of working many more hours than that, overtime, much harder. Now, in order to do that, certain things would have to be in place. For instance, I think the government would have to provide universal free healthcare, which I think they should. The government should provide cheaper higher education, or even free higher education. When the government, for instance, could ensure, you know, cheap public transport and do what they can to bring down housing costs. The thing is here that one of the main reasons why the government doesn't do many of these things, or can't do many of these things, is because people like the folks you describe, they pay off the politicians to make sure that we don't redistribute wealth through the taxation system the way that we should, and we don't. The government won't sort of invest in the kind of infrastructure, creating jobs and distributing the wealth more equitably. So, you know, they can say that they're empathetic, but I don't see why one should put any value whatsoever on those words when their actions are to block every possible move towards redistributing wealth for the benefit of the majority.
We also have this phenomena that we've never had in American history. We have between 8 and 10 million millionaires. It dipped during the recession, but this isn't meaning $1 million excluding the value of your home. And we also have billionaires, the most upper middle class and professionals. We have over 7 million professionals, and they live in the upper middle class. So when you add all these numbers together, which I have, you're around 45 to 50 million people, not a small number of people. So if you then look at 50 million at a country that has 300 and approximately 25 million, you're then asking, what about the other 275 million people? That's, you know, still a lot of people who are not, their needs are not being taken care of. And they're living at or close or slightly above or below the poverty line, with 18 million children that are hungry. We have over 1.6 million children, when they leave school each day, have no home to go to. We have over 12 million senior citizens who are so strapped that some of them are eating cat food because they can't afford human food. And these people are virtually invisible in any discussion today. So when you look at this phenomenon, you're not seeing those people as a whole being guided because they have no advocates. They're not being directed in how they can turn their dire circumstance into something that actually can benefit them, like shared living. So when they do have to make change, there's always this kind of sense of angst, depression, that they were forced into change instead of willingly making that change. Could you address this, please?
Basically, what you drew up is a contrast between, you know, the have-lots and the have-nots, and point out that the great majority belong in the latter group. To me, the model of what you said is this, that, you know, this is a very, very rich country, much richer than any other country has ever been in history, and much richer than the United States has ever been in history. After the Second World War, right, the United States, you know, could finance something like the GI Bill. Now, there's far, far more money in the system sloshing around. And, you know, it's up to us how we decide to use it. What's lacking isn't the money, it's the political will. When it comes to politics, I mean, you, for instance, there focused on poverty and the amount of poverty in the country. I agree that poverty and people living in dire poverty is one of the most important issues, along with the issue that you raised 20 minutes ago, which was climate change and environmental despoliation. Well, there's a political debate going on Monday, and we should have bingo cards with squares with topics like that, the really important topics like the environment, climate change, poverty, and see how many times the moderators raise these questions and how many times the candidates address them. My guess is that you won't be shouting bingo too early.
Well, the one candidate who would address these is Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, but unfortunately she's not invited to the debates. I want to thank you for the good work and the wisdom of frugality, Why Less is More is Less, Princeton University Press, and that you're continuing to remind us that we do have some choices and we should be conscious of the choices we make and try just to make our lives simpler, live more frugally. And as you said about Epicurus, he found joy in that cup of cheese and cup of wine and good conversation. Maybe we should start to emulate that more than what we have in the past. We're watching reality shows, we're eating junk food, and we're hearing from pundits and ideologues that have nothing constructive to share to us about innate wisdom because they have no innate wisdom. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure. Professor
Emrys Westacott, that's Westacott. And look at the new and growing Progressive Radio Network website, and it's up and it'll be added to every day. Have a nice day, everyone.